Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
I've spent my fair share of time out alone in remote places around Alaska. But sometimes I wonder, what would happen if I did get into a bad situation that I couldn't get myself out of? What if I got hurt and I needed somebody to come rescue me? How would I get word out that I was in trouble and who would come get me? Today, I'm hoping to find out some answers to those questions from my guests, the pararescue jumpers of the Alaska Air National Guard. So stick around with me, your host, Adam Verrier, and find out more about the Air National Guard pararescue jumpers here on Outdoor Explorer.
I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in Unalaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Adam Verrier, your host here on Outdoor Explorer. And today I have three guests with me here in the studio. And they are Chelsea Asplund. She's the Chief of Public Affairs for the 176th Wing of the Alaska Air National Guard. I also have Miles Brodsky. He's a combat rescue officer with the 212th Rescue Squadron. And Chris Robertson is a recently retired pararescue jumper with the 212th. And Chris, I think you just retired like a month ago, so congratulations.
Freshly retired.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me here today. I really appreciate it. To start things off, Chelsea, you're the Chief of Public Affairs. It seems appropriate to start things off by asking you to introduce us to the National Guard's 176th Wing, and specifically, what's the mission of the Alaska Air National Guard's Rescue Squadron?
Well, no pressure starting off.
Well, I think one of the incredible things about the 176th Wing is that not only do we have a rescue component, but we also have an airlift as well as an air control squadron. So we have a very broad, very dynamic wing. But specifically looking at our rescue triad, we actually have three rescue squadrons. So we have the 210th, which is our helicopter squadron, the 211th, which is our HC-130 squadron, and then we have the 212th Rescue Squadron, which is our pararescue men and our combat rescue officers. So we have a very diverse rescue capability, oftentimes referred to as the rescue triad, where all of our rescue squadrons will work together in a rescue scenario. And our HC-130Js actually bring a very incredible capability to refuel our HH-60 helicopters so that our pararescue men and our combat rescue officers can then perform their rescue capabilities with the hoist-capable helicopters. So it's an amazing, multifaceted rescue wing, as we're often referred to. But I do want to make sure we caveat that we actually have a very dynamic wing with all of our other missions.
And so what are those other, I mean, the Alaska Air National Guard, you guys would be involved if there was, I don't know, civil unrest and all the sort of things that you hear about the National Guard being used for within Alaska and I guess even other states if it was needed. Also in combat roles if necessary, both in the United States or elsewhere. Is that right?
I mean, the Alaska National Guard, Air and Army, will have both state and federal missions. So across the entirety of the Alaska National Guard, we will respond to federal missions around the globe. We have soldiers deployed in Poland right now. We have airmen deployed in various locations in support of different areas of responsibility. We also have units within the Alaska National Guard that support homeland defense missions. So in place, essentially, deployed in place, if you would, and supporting those homeland defense missions for, you know, NORAD, NORTHCOM, and that way they're never leaving the state. So we actually have federal missions here at home, but then we also have missions to the state. So whether that's response to a natural disaster, we recently had airmen supporting missions in Juneau, missions in Kotzebue, various other areas around the state for flooding or for seasonal needs or whatever the state requests, really. We have airmen and soldiers supporting innovative readiness missions, and that's actually a DOD program, helping build roadways and various other missions around the state of Alaska. So very dynamic, right? Very large National Guard with a complex mission set both at home and overseas.
One thing that I think Chris had mentioned earlier, just before we started this interview, was the primacy of the military mission. And I suppose if something happens in Alaska, if we get invaded or something, I would assume that the National Guard isn't making it their primary mission to find lost people out in the woods. That you've got bigger things going on.
Yeah, that's correct, Adam. Our primary mission on paper, of course, is for the Air Force, rescue and pilots across enemy lines. That's why pararescue exists. I like to sum it up that if the DOD, we are the lone dedicated search and rescue team of the Department of Defense. If the Department of Defense loses anything, be it a person or an item, we have the training to go get it anywhere on this globe, in the ocean, on mountaintops, in the middle of nowhere, in alpine tundra. Like, we have the training to go get it. We're creative problem solvers that think outside the box. We don't really have a doctrine to follow as the rest of the military does, say a checklist. Every mission is completely different. And so we need guys that can creatively think on their feet to do these missions. How unique is that we're in Alaska and we are part of the Alaska Air National Guard, that our rescue squadron was founded originally as the 210th. Years later, we'd break into the 211th, 212th and separate. But it was really founded and the water was carried by Ted Stevens. The 71st Rescue Squadron, back when in the Cold War days, when Russia was a threat that was kind of looming at us, which again, full circle, we're right back at the same place. But we had the 71st, which was a active Air Force rescue team. They closed down part of base relocation and closure, the BRAC. Ted Stevens realized, he's like, these guys are rescuing 4 or 5 Alaskans a weekend. We need a rescue team like this in Alaska. With the remote terrain we have, and as Alaskans, you know, we fly, we float, we snow machine, we're off the road system. So to have a unique squadron such as the 212th, or I should say the 176th Wing, in position in Alaska is truly something no other state has. But no other state has the vast expanses that we do and the way of life we do.
And how often have you been deployed in combat? You've been a PJ for how long?
So I just retired. Actually, I looked at the calendar today. So it's 18 September. So 18 September 1997 is when I signed up. So today marks 27 years from when I came into the military. So yeah, I've been around for a while. I have 7 combat deployments. We've got guys on our team that probably have 13, 14 deployments. And on average, it's about every 18 months to 2 years that we take our turn and we go to whatever hot spot there is in the world that they need us. And if you look at any conflict happening in the world right now that has U.S. forces, there are PJs somewhere there standing alert, ready to go.
Oh, that's interesting. And the PJs are only in Alaska. Is that...
We have PJs in multiple different locations. We have... they're in the U.S. Air Force. They're in the Alaska Air National Guard. And then they're in the Air Force Reserves as well.
I see. Okay. It's not only the Air National Guard, the Alaska Air National Guard that has PJs.
Yep.
It is a type of military service that's done out of other units.
That's correct. There's about 500 PJs worldwide. I believe that number is current right now. But we have active duty teams in Arizona, Georgia, Florida. I'm going to miss some here. We have guard teams in New York and California. Guard teams are easy to remember. Reserve teams in Arizona and Portland, Oregon. Then we have active duty teams as well in Italy. And I am missing one. Teams will pop up. I should say we'll have bases that PJs are located at, and then they'll close and they'll move them around.
I see. And how do PJs differ from other elite troops? Like, for example, you know, we hear about the Navy SEALs. We know that the Marines are, you know, all of the services have elite troops. How are the PJs different? Is it only in that you are in charge of rescuing people and those other units do other types of skilled work?
That's correct, Adam. So we're basically, like Chris was saying, we're the only DoD asset that is built to rescue exclusively, right? But given that the people we are sent out to rescue are very far away, given that they fly, it required a special set of skills and a special set, you know, selection process to get through to make sure that we're getting the right people who can handle very stressful situations and make very complex decisions in stressful situations, as Chris was saying. So a lot of our training overlaps, right, with the other special operations in our sister branches. We are the only ones specifically dedicated to rescue. And like I said, a lot of the skills are the same, but we focus it on getting people home.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
And that was a huge selling point for me when I was in college. You know, I hit this point my sophomore year where I was looking at, you know, I had adventure. I wanted to get out the door. I was an English major. I was going to teach kids in a high school classroom in 2 years. And it hit me that those kids were going to be 4 years younger than I was, and I hadn't seen the world yet. So I looked into everything, and I looked into the Peace Corps. I looked into Navy SEALs. I looked into foreign exchange. Like, I just wanted to get out and go do something. I was really intrigued by the SEALs. I was really intrigued by Force Recon and Special Forces. Like, I wanted to do something elite. But there was something about their mission that didn't quite sell me. Something where I was like, hey, I can do that for a week or so, and that'd be fun. But, like, it wasn't a calling. Then when I found out about pararescue, I'm like, you're telling me these guys get to go to military freefall school, special forces dive school. They climb mountains. They swim oceans. Like, they're some of the most elite troops out there. And their whole mission is to rescue somebody, to bring somebody back to America or to safety. I'm like, sold. And I pretty much left the college door swinging on the hinges. And I'm like, this is a calling. This is what I'm supposed to do. Huh. 27 years later, here I am.
I'd like to ask either you or Miles, whoever wants to take this. How does a person get into the PJs? Say I'm a high school sophomore and I hear this show and I think that sounds pretty – I mean, I want to be in the military, but this sounds like a real adventure and I think I can do it. How do I do it? Can I come straight off the couch and get in a helicopter and go rescue some people? What kind of training needs to happen, and how do you go about becoming a PJ?
Yeah, good question. So number one, you got to be fit. And that fitness, of course, is going to be physically fit, but mental fitness as well. You have to be tenacious and you got to be resilient. There are plenty of amazing athletes that show up to the selection course and they just don't have a concept of teamwork. And when they fail, and you will fail in the selection course, the instructors are going to make sure you fail somewhere. A lot of times they'll take what you're strongest at and make you fail that. And it's a big mind game. So are you the guy that when you hit that failure point, you just break and you can't focus on the next task? Because if that's the case, you're not going to make it. If you can put that failure behind you and keep driving on, those are the guys we want. We want that never quit attitude. But yeah, number one, physical fitness. And then you sign up. Normally, I have to contact a recruiter first. They're going to give you what's called the pass test. And I could be outdated on the pass test. I believe we have a new physical fitness test now. But they're going to give you a physical fitness test to make sure you can swim, you can run, you can do calisthenics. From that point, you get a school date and you're going to go to basic training, which now, granted, this is from 30 years ago, but basic training for me was 6 weeks. I think it's a little bit longer now. The selection course is 10 weeks. So after basic training, you go to pararescue selection course. Now they're calling it the ANS, assessment and selection. But that was 10 weeks when I went through. That has a very high dropout rate. We started with 104 in my first class. We graduated 8 of us after Hell Week, which was 3 weeks in, and then only 4 of those graduated the final class. I actually got set back with another 4 individuals into the next class. That one also started with over 100, graduated 12 of us. So pretty high, about a 90% dropout rate. And then from there, you go to Special Forces Scuba School or Air Force Scuba School, military Airborne School, Fort Benning, Georgia, Military Freefall School in Yuma, Arizona, SEER School for 3 weeks, which they teach basically how to survive in any environment, be it hostile or remote. The paramedic course, which that continues to increase in length, but it's about 9 months. And then you finally tie it all up with 6 months at pararescue school. So it's about a 2-year pipeline. And then you come out and you're the new guy on your team.
Okay. I guess you're the new guy on the team, and that probably brings its own set of complications.
It definitely does.
Well, so one thing that you might have said, but I either didn't hear it or didn't understand it. What if you want to be a pararescue jumper, you go into basic training, and then you're one of the 90% that don't make it to becoming a pararescue jumper? Mm-hmm. I assume at this point you're signed up to do something else for the military then. And if you want to be a pararescue jumper, you need to be ready to be in the Air Force doing something, even if it's not pararescue jumper, because you've signed up.
Miles, you want to finish that statement?
Yeah, sure. I think it depends on, I think when I was going through, you signed in with a contract to go pararescue, right? And at that time, the military was relatively full. So this was probably around 15 years ago, and it was relatively full. And so they were saying, hey, it's either make pararescue or you're out, right? Sometimes it depends on what's going on in the military and the needs of the military. Sometimes you can get reclassed into some other AFSC, basically a job in the Air Force. A lot of people go to some of the other jobs that are peripheral to pararescue, such as tactical air controller, or TACP we call them, or SEER specialist, survive, evade, resist, escape instructor. So they're going to be the one teaching the skills. And then sometimes it's just, hey, we're going to reclass you into another job. It just all depends on the needs of the military. I will say that it's a little different if you want to go active duty or guard. And I'm going to put a plug in here for the Air National Guard, because I was lucky enough to start in the Air National Guard. Chris, I believe you started in the Air National Guard as well, right?
Yes, I did.
So we're what we call guard babies. We were in the guard the whole way. If you go active duty, you have a little less say in the way you do things. With the guard, you can actually reach out to the guard team prior to even joining the military. You'll do a tryout with either, you can join if you're interested in coming up here to Alaska or California or New York, you could reach out to those teams, tell them you want to be a PJ or a combat rescue officer. And usually they hold tryouts, and you can come in and try out before you even sign up for the military. And then that team says, okay, we think you have what it takes. We'll take you in as a PJ or combat rescue officer. And then you start the process with the guard. The training doesn't matter. Whether you're active duty or guard, everything is the same. And that's why we can deploy to support the federal mission. The difference is that usually it's a part-time position when you initially join. There are full-time positions. Both Chris was a full-time and I'm full-time now. They're a little bit more rare, but you get a lot more flexibility with your life. And the nice thing is you don't have to move all the time. So you can move when you want to. So I started out in the California Air National Guard and then decided we wanted to come up here to Alaska. So it allows you a little bit more flexibility. That being said, if you don't make it and you're in the guard, again, you get a little bit more flexibility to work with the guard to say, hey, I just wanted to be a PJ and I didn't make it, so I don't want to be in the military anymore. The guard can help you get out, or, hey, there's another job I'd like to do in the guard. Can you help me do that? There's a little bit more options. Once you go active duty, it's all about the needs of the Air Force at that point.
Yeah, active duty. I mean, when we went through, we always joke around about that. When I went through, it was hard. That's always the joke of the old PJ.
Okay,
but
right.
One thing that they did differently is when you went through back in my time, you were, if you wanted to be a PJ, you were pretty much, you were on that pararescue track. It was your say. Now, active duty, what they've done is they have a team of psychiatrists. They have coaches there. They're watching guys the entire step of the process. And they will decide for them who becomes a PJ, who becomes combat controller, who becomes a tech P. To me, that'd be extremely stressful. But again, if you go guard, you're on a PJ track. They're not taking that away from you.
And Miles, you've done a lot of rescues. You did two in one day just earlier this week. So you've got to have a crazy story of something that has happened to you out on one of these missions.
Yeah, I think one of the ones that pops in my mind was a few years ago. I was on alert with a teammate on the HC-130J, so the fixed wing. We got a call from a village on the Yukon River Delta, a village up there, that there was an injured individual who had lost a substantial amount of blood and needed exfil immediately or medical attention. We work – I will say we work closely with the villages because a lot of them have minimal resources, right? They might have health aides who are doing the best they can, but at their different locations, they might not have everything they need. So we really do try to help them. In this case, we got the call saying LifeMed, other entities could not go in because the weather was too bad. It was in the middle of essentially a blizzard, a snowstorm. It was negative 10 degrees on the ground. We launched. We knew that the person needed blood, so we picked up blood. Me and one other teammate got on the plane, and two other teammates got on the helicopter, and we decided we got to try to get there with the helicopter. Well, the helicopter couldn't make it in because of the weather. They got stopped in the passes, and they just had to push down. And at that point, me and my teammate decided, with the crew, that we got to be the ones to go in and do this. Like, let's go to this village and see if we can parachute in here, even in this horrible weather. And in the middle of the night. So we're under night vision goggles. There's only two of us. We have giant rucks on because we have to put – so we have our parachute that's already 70 pounds, I think. And then we have these giant rucks on front of us, and we got our night vision goggles on. And the PJ team leader, he's trying to do jump master procedures. The ramp didn't work for us, so we actually had to go out the side door, which is a little bit more complicated, a little bit tighter, and it's completely dark, right? And it's just the two of us back there. The loads are there helping us out, the load masters who are part of the crew, but really it's important for me and my, the team member. We're doing safety checks on each other in the dark, getting ready to jump out of this plane.
And from around what elevation would you be doing this typically?
So we can push it down on a static line parachute, right? We're free fall certified, yep. Which means we can, fall out of the plane, but you need a much higher altitude for that. Luckily, our career field actually developed the Razzle, mm-hmm. Ram Air Static Line. So it's basically a square canopy, not like the round ones that you've seen in maybe movies or the Army uses. We do use those. Those go low. But these are steerable canopies, just like the ones you see skydivers use, actually come out on a static line. And we can go out much lower because when we jump out of the aircraft, it's deployed by a static line immediately. So there's no – it doesn't require us to pull. So we went as low as the pilot was able to get us at our lowest altitude, which was 1,250 feet. Wow. When you jump out of the plane at that level under night vision goggles and it's just two of you next to the river that if you hit, you will probably not survive. And you got to make that point. You don't get a lot of time to land, and it was in the middle of the night. So we're going on it was about 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning by the time we exited the aircraft to get to this person. But I will say, the PJ team leader, he did an amazing job giving us a good spot, put us out right where we need to go. We both landed, and the people waiting for us to land because we were relaying to the RCC that, hey, there's going to be somebody coming to help you. But there was kind of some lost in, the telephone game of how they were going to get down to us. They were expecting a helicopter. They did not expect two guys under night vision goggles to be landing next to them with these giant parachutes on. To then bring the help they needed. And this was a situation where, we got to that individual just in time because we were able to deliver him the blood and it looked like he rose from the dead. And then we were able to secure his injuries and make sure that he got to higher care. And then eventually we stabilized him. The helicopter, the weather cleared and the helicopter was able to pick us up about 6 hours later with the rest of the crew. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was another long day, but very satisfying, and we're glad to help the community out like that, especially those remote villages that have less resources sometimes and need our help.
Yeah, I can believe it must feel great to come home from missions like that regularly.
Yeah, yeah. And not every mission is not everyone. Right. We can't save everybody, but it's nice when we can.
Yeah. Chelsea, I'd like to give you – I gave you the first word, the most difficult word. I'd like to give you the last word too. I mean, we've been talking to pararescue men about their side in this. But of course, you got the people who need to get rescued too. They're the other part of this thing. We got the public that's listening to this. Is there anything they can do to help the pararescue men of the 212th?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I think there's kind of been a theme through a lot of this, right? We're talking a lot about the complexity of rescue environment, of, you know, sometimes it's not just the Alaska National Guard pararescue teams or the Alaska National Guard rescue triad, but we might have LifeMed involved. We might have the Park Service involved. And in all of these situations, one of the biggest things for the listeners, for the Alaska enthusiasts, right, those people like me who didn't grow up here, but I came here with the active duty and then said, how do I stay? Because I fell in love with the Big Mountain. I fell in love with the backcountry. But I also want to make sure that on my worst day in Alaska, that the right entity shows up at the right time, because you want to reduce your own recovery timeline, right? The way you can do that, knowing how to have the two-way communication and being able to communicate your nature of your injuries or being able to communicate the terrain, is going to help the Rescue Coordination Center make the best decision for your situation. Because there are oftentimes situations where the entity dispatched may arrive and determine we can't reach the patient or we don't have the right medical equipment. But that is a process that they will have to go through unless you or I, as the person in the backcountry, can give that information to help the rescue assets dispatch the right personnel the first time. But also understanding the complexity of it, right? And on the backside, looking out for supporting your public information and supporting the teams that are coming back from doing the mission. And that's really what we're here to do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA. And today we're talking with members of the Alaska Air National Guard's Rescue Squadron. We'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Adam Verrier, and today I'm talking with three members of the Alaska Air National Guard's Rescue Squadron. My guests here in the studio are Chelsea Asplund, Miles Brodsky, and Chris Robertson. Chelsea Asplund is the Chief of Public Affairs. And Chelsea, I'd like to ask you, how did you get involved with the 176th? And you're the Chief of Public Affairs. What is your role with the 176th?
Thanks so much for asking. I actually grew up on the active duty Air Force. So I spent 8 years as an air battle manager, and I flew in the AWACS, which we do have them here in Alaska. So if you've seen the large 707 airframe with the radar disc on top, I spent the first 8 years of my career controlling military aircraft from sitting backwards, no windows, in the back of an AWACS.
Yeah, and so you, just so that people know, in case people don't know what an AWACS does,
Airborne Warning and Control System. Okay. So it's essentially, the easiest way to describe it would be air traffic control of military operations. So name a situation, whether that is a combat zone or a emergency response, disaster response, anytime you need military or civilian, civilian air control, you would have military operators in the AWACS helping control that airspace.
Miles, were you involved? I mean, you guys are out. We were talking before this interview started. You're out rescuing people multiple times per day, frequently, and multiple times per week, just about all the time, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we do hold a 24/7 alert, like I said, and as able when civilians get in trouble and the call comes to us, as long as our military job doesn't take precedent, we can jump in and help out, and we get asked a lot. This weekend, or actually it started out on Monday, we made it through the weekend, there was no missions, and then Monday morning at 5 a.m. it kicked off. We ran two back-to-back missions on the Yukon River complex, medical patients, and involving getting them to higher care. We used the helicopter for one mission. The pilot did a great job at landing on a very complicated bank to go address the first patient. And in the middle of working that patient, me and another teammate were working, we got the call that there was another complex medical patient that needed to be medevaced 180 miles northeast of that location. And so we actually had a PJ team in the HC-130J, so the fixed wing aircraft flying overhead. So they actually moved forward and parachuted onto a little riverbank, and were able to help out with that patient and get them stabilized. While we finished up with our patient, jumped back on the helicopter, and then went and picked them up with their patient and took everybody to the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital.
Yeah, that's so, really complex.
Yeah, and that took about 12 hours. So by the time we left to the time we landed back at J-Bear was about 12 hours. we swapped crews, and the night crew took over. And at that point, they got two back-to-back missions and worked the full 12 hours as well. They responded to a plane crash not far from J-Bear, picked up two people, minor injuries, and then responded to two hunters that were actually – we call it cliffed out, which is basically they were going up a cliff. Weather came in. They couldn't get down any safe way. So the helicopter went in with two of the PJs and they hoisted over 200 feet. The 200-foot hoist was pretty complicated, but they got them out safely.
Huh. And the parachuting that happened onto the Yukon River, is that done out of the helicopter or out of a C-130, or can it happen either way?
Well, see, that's what's nice about our triad, right? It gives us a lot of different options. So we, as the PJs and the CROWs, or the combat rescue officers, we're the ones who got to get out of the plane and onto the ground, right, and get to the patient or the injured person. And so when we're in a helicopter, we can do that with the hoist. We can rappel out. We can fast rope out. There's a lot of options to get down from the helicopter. The easiest way is for them to just air land, right? And we always try to go with that. The helicopter is a little bit slower than the C-130, right? So the C-130 can get there before the helicopter, and that's the aircraft that we parachute out of. We do parachute out of helicopters for fun or training.
Okay.
Sorry, for training only. But it is fun. But for the mission, we would be parachuting out of the fixed wing, the HC-130J.
Yeah.
And that allows us to get on the ground and provide our medical care that is often life-saving, stabilize the patient, and then actually manage the situation, right, and decide how we're going to get that person out. And it's important to note that, we are also trained to do things in the maritime environment as well. We parachute into the water. One of my first missions ever was 1,000 nautical miles in the Pacific Ocean. And we flew 6 hours to their location and parachuted in with our boat. And that was it. It was just us out there to go help an injured sailor, basically, on a small sailboat. We have a lot of different training with this. And being able to parachute in is a really good option because it gets us there quickly. And then we can, like I said, manage the situation and decide, okay, this person's really critical. We need to risk the helicopter air refueling multiple times to get out through weather to get this person to higher care. Or, hey, it's not that bad. Actually, we're going to set up camp, keep them stable. We'll wait for weather to clear or find a good way to get out. We manage risk very well. And getting us in this situation, I really call PJs and CROWs risk reducers, right? Commanders love to have us around. We get attached, like Chris was saying, to the NPS. When we work with NPS, that helps them reduce their risk, right, because we can help facilitate rescues. And on the federal side, it's important. You mentioned Navy SEALs and special forces in the Army. We also help reduce their risk by attaching with them a lot of times.
Okay.
or supporting them on their mission as a full team. But we're just risk reducers. That's what we do. When we get into the situation, things calm down. We can help people medically. We can help facilitate logistics, all the complicated things that come with getting people out of very difficult situations.
Yeah, one thing you just mentioned, you were just talking about a rescue in the Pacific, and the first thing that came to my mind, probably to a lot of listeners' minds, would be we also have the Coast Guard. That it seems like there would be some overlap, that maybe you and the Coast Guard would coordinate and say, well, who should go get these guys? And you'd probably make a decision based on a variety of factors, complex factors probably.
Yeah, one thing that some capabilities that we bring, the Coast Guard, at least early on in my career, and I'm not quite sure if I'm speaking accurately today, but they only had about a 300-mile range away from a fuel source because they can't refuel in midair like our helicopters can.
Yeah. You're and in PAVE, are they called PAVOC?
PAVOCs, okay. Yeah. And that's just a modified version. It's the PAVE modification that they put on a Black Hawk. So it has a refueling probe, has some more advanced avionics inside of it. And of course, it has our gun mounts when we go overseas, either the minigun or the 50 caliber machine gun that's on the side. But so the Coast Guard, they typically are about they've got a range, and like I said, I think it's about 300 miles, and we can beat that range two ways with the combination of the 211th and the 210th flying together, the refueling C-130 that can refuel the helicopter, and then the fact that all of our PJs we can parachute in. So that will typically give us missions further out.
Okay.
And I think it's important. It kind of goes back to the jurisdiction thing I was saying. The waterways are owned by the Coast Guard. So the ocean is owned by the Coast Guard. So those rescues we did, the 212th, 210th, and 211th just recently did a rescue, I think about a month ago, just south of Kodiak. It was in the water. They had to parachute in to go again, an injured sailor. But it was beyond the reach of the Coast Guard, their helicopter, as Chris was saying. And so basically the Coast Guard usually receives the call first and then goes, okay, this is either beyond our range or it's so medically complex because a lot of their rescue swimmers aren't as medically trained. All of us, all the pararescuemen, the enlisted pararescuemen are paramedic certified. So we become nationally registered paramedics. The combat rescue officers, that's not the case because they're on the officer track. So they're, it's just not required for them. Those of us who happen to be prior PJs get to keep our national registry. And it's important here in Alaska because we're on alert and being a paramedic definitely helps. But again, it's all about the jurisdiction. So the Coast Guard says, hey, this is beyond our capabilities. And there's no ego involved with rescue, right? Because people's lives are on the stake here. So we don't want to mess with that. So they go, hey, we can't do this. Can you guys get them? And that's when we step up.
Yeah, your story about multiple rescues in one day. In fact, four rescues basically
in
a day.
24 because, hours, yeah.
Yeah, over two crews reminded me of a situation. I had some friends who flipped an airplane. They were totally all right, but they were in a remote place. They ended up with a upside down airplane in a little private plane on a runway that had too much snow on it. And so I was told, I only heard parts of the story, but from what I understand, the PJs came and got them. But when it became clear, I think the PJs were coming to get them, but then it became clear that they were totally fine, no injuries, and they had enough warm stuff that they could survive for as long – they could have stayed overnight if they needed to. And I think the National Guard said, well – you're going to have to sit tight for 6 or 8 hours because we got to go do this. This other thing has come up and we got people that are in a lot of trouble. We got to get those guys. And then we'll come back this evening, try to make a nice landing spot for us and we'll come back and see you then. And then it worked out. But that sounds like a situation you would run into fairly frequently, I would think.
Yeah, I think you kind of described my memory of missions is we do get a lot of assists, you know, where the people have wrecked their plane or wrecked their vessel, but they're okay. And that's always a good happy ending at the end of the day. And at that point, we pick them up. And now the rule is we either have to return you to a hospital or to law enforcement. So we either have to find a state trooper, park ranger, or drop you on the roof of Providence, which, you know, right out your back door here.
Right. And that's where these people ended up, I think. Mm-hmm. How many people do you end up with in a helicopter? Do you have a crew that you work with that's just – it's a unit and there's whatever, three of you or four of you or six of you or whatever, and you guys go out on this mission together? And I mean, how many people fit in one of those – what is a PAVOC helicopter crew, for example? You got a pilot and a co-pilot.
Pilot, co-pilot. You have two SMAWs, which are special mission aviators. The lingo for them, we used to call them gunners back in the day, or flight engineers, but they sit on the right and the left side, and they're scanners, and they can also work mechanical issues. And then we typically have two PJs or a PJ and a combat rescue officer in the back. And that can change depending on the complexity of the mission. If we have, say, like a high-angle mission where we have to set up ropes and pulleys to extract somebody off a cliff, we're going to have more people on board. And I don't know. I mean, the old joke, you know, how many people does a PAVOC fit? We can always fit one more.
Okay.
It's really air. It depends on their fuel and their abilities to take off and how heavy they are. But, I mean, we load it full of people, right? As long as we can still do medicine in there. It is – flying in a helicopter, especially the PAVOCs when you're in the back, is not the most comfortable feeling. So, you know, it's not always a comfortable ride. Okay. Especially if you're completely packed in. But we've loaded 8 people before just to get them out because it's better for us. Well, you know, as you know, weather here in Alaska changes quickly, so we don't mess around. So if we can fit people, the pilots usually make it work, and we try to fit as many people as we can to just get everybody out so we know we don't have to go back for anything.
We have a great picture in the hallway where we work of during the Yukon Quest years ago, we rescued a couple dog mushers and their teams that have been stuck in weather. And there's a picture of the PAVOC. You look into the back and it's like 20, 25 sled dogs and then two PJs.
Right. Yeah. What is your Miles, you're a combat rescue officer, and Chris, you're a pararescue jumper. Is that your title or were?
Yeah. And just some quick corrections on semantics. Old guys get really upset when you call them pararescue jumpers.
Okay.
So yeah, we're pararescue men. The PJ annotation came from flight orders, and I think that's something from the Vietnam War, like just on the orders that had the entire crew listed beside everybody's name was their duty code, and the duty code was marked PJ. And then I think the civilian world has just kind of adopted that, as you would, to be like, oh, PJ, they jump out of planes, so they got to be para jumpers. But yeah, the true term is pararescue.
Okay.
And the great thing about being a pararescue man is you are the tactician. Like, you're the guy hanging on the end of the hoist hook for the majority of your career. Whereas as a combat rescue officer, I'll let Miles talk to that, but they have a little bit more responsibility.
Yeah, and the training pipelines are the same. The selection is the same. So PJs and CROWs will go in together into the selection process and the whole schooling that Chris talked about. The only difference for combat rescue officers is, like I said earlier, we don't go through paramedics, right? So Chris said it well. The PJs are the tacticians. They're the ones who understand how to go down the rope safely, how to be jump masters, very skilled jump masters to get us out of planes in a very tight situations. And they're really managing the tactical team, right? And the combat rescue officer looks at the bigger picture and is there trying to make sure helping with the team leader as the team commander to look one step ahead, and they work together to get the mission done. They're really handling risk. They're kind of an extension of the commander on the tactical level to say, okay, are we utilizing risk or out of our risk boundaries basically to where we have to potentially go up to higher permission to execute this mission if we go outside of our commander's intent. But it also sends, as a career field, we go different trajectories. So we will be commanders in the squadron, whereas PJs will end up being chiefs in the squadron, right? That's kind of the highest level. And then, higher level commander positions. And the idea for combat rescue officers too, I think the combat rescue officer career field was started in like 2000 or 2001. So it's mm-hmm. relatively new, because before PJs would just fall under pilots with the three squadrons. That Chelsea was talking about, the 210th, 211th, 212th, all used to be one squadron. Mm-hmm. And it would just fall under one pilot. And as the rescue triad got bigger and more complex, pararescue at one point decided, well, we need officers, because that's how you get representation and advocacy within any branch of the military, right? And so they developed the combat rescue officer career field in 2000 or 2001. So it's relatively new. It's getting older. But compared to other, pilots have been around forever and they're officers. They decided that there was a need for this, for that advocacy, and to move up into higher level strategic discussions about rescue in the military as a whole.
Yeah. In a way, the rescue swimmers in the Coast Guard, they're a good example of what we used to look like, where they belong to a helicopter squadron and they're enlisted guys in the back of the helicopter. They're tied to that helicopter. That's how pararescue used to be. We used to be tied to the aircraft, and our commander would be a helicopter pilot or a C-130 pilot. Recognizing the need to evolve and understanding that we don't, as PJs, we have such specialized skills, we should not be tied to an aircraft. We love our flying squadrons, but we've done missions in Alaska. We literally have gotten on an Alaska Railroad train car and taken that to a location because the weather was so bad, and then hiked up. We've done deployments where we don't have any aircraft. We have vehicles. And so we really can operate completely independently. But with that, we need officers. We need higher advocacy. And so the best way to describe the PJ versus the CROW differentiation is, and many of your listeners will understand this, but the CROW is the officer, whereas the PJ is the enlisted guy.
Okay. Yeah, it's been fascinating to me throughout this conversation how much decision-making comes into play, even at the level of the rescuer. It's not that you're just doing... Oh yeah, I gotta. My boss says I gotta jump out of this helicopter, and I guess I'll just do what they say. I mean, of course, there's a chain of command, but the idea that you're making decisions even in the middle of this rescue, you're trying to fly someplace, and oh, it's all fogged in. Well, we gotta figure something else out. Can't go in the fog. We're gonna run into the cliff. And so it sounds like, especially Miles, your job has a lot of decision making.
Yeah, and I will say, like in the military, the commander owns the risk, right? Mm-hmm. And commander, depending on how much authority you have, is how much risk you have. And I want to say something about the 176 Wing. We have amazing leadership all the way from the wing commander all the way down, really all the way through the state, that really support our mission and trust the people down the chain of command. Because what they do is they say, here's my intent and here's how I want you to meet that intent. As long as the risk falls in here, you're okay to do it. Parachuting out into the middle of Alaska on your own in the middle of the night in a winter storm or whatever to save someone's life is a very risky event, right? And the commander ultimately owns that risk, either at the group level or at the wing level. But they trust the tacticians and the people at that level to make those difficult calls, because a lot of times military is not the military. Folks can be risk adverse, and we are not. We address risk very intelligently, and we say, okay, we can do this. We can make this happen. And when you're on the mission, you got to make that call very quickly. You can't wait for up and down communications. And so our leadership really supports making critical decisions, you know, at the moment that it can be that it's most important, which is at the tactical level. And I will say, it doesn't take a combat rescue officer to be there to make those decisions, because you know, it could be two PJs on alert, and that's the kind of person that we're looking for, because we put that kind of responsibility on PJ team leaders as well to say, hey, you got to make this call. Whether, you know, you have to balance whether jumping out of this airplane and that risk meets your commander's intent and will save the life of this person. Is it worth that risk to do this? Because this is about to be a very risky mission. And you're making those decisions in split time. And we've had lots of jump missions recently. We've had lots of risky helicopter missions. And that goes for the crews as well, right? The commander, the wing commander, and the group commander are saying, hey, we trust you to make the call to fly through this pass. You know, we have some incredible helicopter pilots. We have incredible C-130 pilots who are willing to say, you know what, I can do this. And at the same time, it's important to know that we say no to those things too, because it shows that, hey, that's too risky, and maybe the folks at the, on the ground, just like your friends, they can camp for the night and we'll attempt it tomorrow. Or, hey, that is risky, but that person is bleeding out and we need to get there. We'll find a way to get there. But it's important to understand that, you know, the risk is delegated down from our commanders, and we have awesome leadership that supports that risk being made at that important – at that level.
Yeah, and this sounds like it goes right back to what you were saying, Chris, at the top of this interview when you were talking about – we were talking about the training program a little bit, and that you were looking for people who were not only physically fit but mentally able to make decisions under stress. I remember talking with Jim Settle, who you mm-hmm. and I – of course, I'm sure we all know him. I knew him from high school, as I knew you from high school. Mm-hmm. And I remember running into Jim Settle as he was going through training. I saw him in Anchorage someplace on a sidewalk someplace, and he said, oh, I've been in the pool and they're trying to drown me in the pool every day. And he said, I don't know if this is going to work out. Like, I'm so on the edge here. And I don't think I'm violating Jim's trust by saying that. He said it was very, very hard. And I got the impression – it's been a long time ago since he went through training and since I talked to him about it, so I don't remember all the details. But I got the impression that it was kind of like he's getting dunked in the pool and held underwater, but then he's got to make decisions while he's trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of – it sounds like that's probably – typical of a lot of the type of training that you go through to see if you're then able to make these decisions about, you know, should we fly this helicopter in or should we not, considering that we got three different things going on and we got people, whether in combat or in civilian.
Yeah, we need cool heads and we need grace under fire. And there's a reason why the training pipeline is so difficult. And we obviously are getting a phenomenal product. When you can take an E-5 and an E-6 and send them 1,000 miles out in the middle of winter to parachute into a cabin with no sight reconnaissance, with no intel. You know, I mean, other military units would do that. It would take them 3-4 days of planning and they'd drop in 100 guys. What we're doing is a beautiful thing, and nobody else in the military is entrusting their lower ranks the way we do and putting as much pressure on them the way we do. And it speaks to the training. It speaks to the leadership.
Well, I've been wanting to hear crazy stories. I was hoping I'd come in here and we'd just do nothing but tell crazy stories the whole time. But I've been so fascinated by what we've been talking about that I haven't been able to get to it. But I do want to ask, you know, can you give me an example of a rescue maybe that each of you have been on that sort of demonstrates maybe as a civilian, I would say crazy situations. You as a professional may say, I don't know, complex mission.
Do you want to rock, paper, scissors for this one, Miles?
I think you should go. You've got a lot more experience in Alaska.
You know, and I'll say it again. You know, Alaska, we actually, I don't know if I've said this already, but we are the busiest rescue team in the Air Force. And we do more missions combined more missions in the active duty or the entire rest of the force combined. We typically, I think last year we saved like 116 people. So we're busy, and that's a typical year for us. So it is hard to like look back in the career, but I mean, one that really stands out in my mind, must've been 2005. We had a freighter. It was a 600-foot freighter out in the Gulf of Alaska. It was 1,000 miles. It was actually closer to Portland than it was to Anchorage. And they gave us the lowdown on it. When you initially get kind of the dispatch information, as civilian paramedics would call it, but for us, you know, it's that RCC message. Nothing's accurate the first time. And so what we originally heard is, hey, we have a guy on a ship with an appendicitis. It's a Filipino crew. It's a Colombian vessel. And it is owned by a Japanese company. And they kind of looked at the information. And they're like, we're pretty sure that those three countries are correct, but we're not quite sure if we have the titles correct. And so we realize this guy's in a – we get the patient information. He's in a pretty bad state, and we were worried about him rupturing his appendix out to sea. And so load up on a C-130, didn't even entertain the helicopters. We knew they were going to be the platform to get us off. But we started loading up. Got a boat on board. If you ever stop by the PJ section, which I'd love to give you a tour, we have boats with parachutes on them. We have jet skis with parachutes on them. We have snow machines with parachutes on them. You walk through our warm storage, and it's a bunch of vehicles with parachutes on them. And so we really are prepared for any type of mission. But we load up a boat. We actually requested an ER doctor to come with us because we knew we were going to be pushing antibiotics, so we're out of our scope. We didn't know if there was going to be any type of surgical procedures that he was going to have to talk us through, but just in case, we invited this doctor on board. We actually got two ER doctors. Flew 1,000 miles, pushed the ramps package out, jump out, hit the water. And I should step back a little bit. When you parachute out of an airplane 1,000 miles out to sea, and that gate opens up and you start thinking like, man, I am a long way from home. The boat goes out first. You're supposed to wait 5 seconds because it has parachutes on it, and they got to pull those in so you don't jump into the deployment lines. The first guy did not wait. So the boat went out. He jumped out right on top of him. Second guy followed him out. Third guy, I'm the third guy. I look back at the fourth guy, and I'm like, I'm supposed to wait, but my team is leaving. And so I just kind of pushed the bags away and jumped out. And then the fourth guy did what he was supposed to. He waited the 5 seconds. The bags came in. The crew down below, it turns out it was the captain's first time being the captain, like having the boat on his own. And so he has appendicitis. He's already questioning, is he doing the right thing? There's such a language barrier. He doesn't understand that we're coming to rescue him. Like, we're going to jump in with parachutes, because nobody in their right mind would expect in the middle of the ocean a plane to fly over and guys to jump out. He would expect a boat to show up. So he actually thought we were just an airplane, just out of the blue, unrelated, and we were all bailing out of the airplane because it was crashing. And so he drops his lifeboat in the water. We have our lifeboat. One of our guys, you meet some of the most unique people in pararescue. And so one of our guys, he spoke Spanish, he spoke Japanese, and he spoke Filipino, and he spoke Tagalog. And so we hit the water, and the guys, you know, they motor up in their boat, and you can't really see them. They got all their garb on. He starts speaking Spanish to them, and they don't respond. So some of them Japanese, they don't respond. And then he starts speaking Tagalog, and now they're having this conversation. And I'm looking at this guy like, I had no idea you spoke four different languages. They motor us over to the side of the ship, and it's like the cliffs of insanity, because you have this ladder they drop down. It's not like you have an elevator. And so they drop down this ladder, this giant Jacob's ladder, and I'm the young guy, and I'm in a dry suit, and I got a med bag, and I got to climb up this boat. And they actually have these little like crow's nests that you can take a break halfway up and like duck in, shake your arms out, and start climbing. But I'm looking down like, I cannot fall off this ladder. And then, of course, we get on top of the ship, and the patient is the very top deck of this ship. So now we're running up this tiny little staircase, and get to the patient. I'm trying to do an assessment on my dry suit. The boat's rocking back and forth. We're getting seasick. And I realize, I'm like, I need to get this dry suit off because it's like 100 degrees in this room. And I'm wearing a dry suit that's made for Alaska. It's not made for that far into the Pacific. And the Filipino crew, when they saw me trying to get out of my dry suit, they just said, oh, we'll help. And they completely ripped me out of my dry suit. And so we end up treating this guy for about 24 hours. The helicopters at that point, they catch up. It was a lot of air refuelings. It was like 7 to 10 air refuelings it took them to get to us. They landed on the ship. There's a tradition when you do an open ocean mission as a PJ, you steal the life ring from the boat. And so once I loaded the patient, I turned around and ran back and grabbed the life ring, and I instantly get tackled by like 10 Filipinos. And they were
it's their mission not to let the life ring go.
Yeah, and so we're in this tug of war, and the pilots are looking at me like, "What are you doing?" And they're like, "Get on the helicopter." And so then, you know, we fly back to Kodiak. As we land in Kodiak, you know, and we got our dry suits on again. I've got mine totally ripped open. You know, we push this patient into an ambulance. The ambulance takes us to the hospital, and now I have to transfer over to the doctor. And the doctor is looking at me, and he's like, "Wait," he's like, and I'm giving him the medical report for the patient, and he's looking at me. He's not taking in anything I'm telling him about the medical condition of the patient. He's looking at my dry suit. He's looking at me, and he's like, "Where was this guy?" And I'm like, "He was like 1,000 miles south." He's like, "And you flew a helicopter there?" And I'm like, "No, we jumped out of an airplane." And he's like pulling on my dry suit. And he's like, "No, you didn't. Like, you didn't do that." Right. And I'm like, "Doc, patient, appendicitis. Like, this is what's important.
Let's stay focused here."
But yeah, I mean, and one thing I did forget, when I climbed to the top of the ladder, you know, I walked into like the helm, and I'm you know, the Navy guys are going to butcher me on this one. But whatever it is where the captain sits, like I walk in there and I can't speak the language, but I just point on the map. I see Kodiak and I like point and I'm like, "Turn the boat." And I feel the entire ship start turning towards Kodiak. I'm like, "That's where we're going. That's where we need to go." And I remember thinking, I'm like, man, I think I was like 23, 24 at the time. I'm like, "I'm the most powerful 24-year-old on this boat." Like,
right.
It's just, you know, you see such bizarre things. And you have such a fun, crazy experience in this job. You never know what mission's coming next. You never know where you're going to be. It could be on the top of Denali, or it could be an earthquake in Islamabad. Yeah. It is such an amazing career that really fills up your passport and gives you a ton of different experiences.
Yeah, it sounds like the doctor at the hospital in Kodiak had the same reaction I would have. Like, what?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to figure this out later because this doesn't make sense.
You know, and there's other things like that. You know, we have the motors on our boats, which we seem to break a lot of them. And earlier on in my career, I was conversing with a dude from Mercury or Yamaha or whoever it was, and he's trying to like walk me through what's going wrong with our boat. He's like, "All right, well, give me the lay down of like, give me the background of what happened when you experienced this problem." He's like, talk me back. And at the point where I was telling him, "Okay, we bundled it up, we threw it out of the back of a cargo airplane and it hit the ocean." He's like, "You did what?" So yeah, we do some weird stuff in this job.
Yeah. Well, it sounds really fascinating. It's been a fascinating conversation for me. When I was in high school, I thought I would join the military. I wanted to do that, and then my life took me in a different direction. But I had relatives in the military, and I didn't know anything about the pararescuemen. But when I was in high school, this would have been what I would have wanted to be all over if I could have pulled it off. I think we're out of time. I hate to say it, but I think we've run out of time for today, and I got another hour's worth of questions I got for you guys. Maybe we'll have to do it some other time and ask all the other questions I've got for you. But I want to thank the three of you for taking the time to talk to me today. My guests today were Chelsea Asplund, Miles Brodsky, and Chris Robertson of the Alaska Air National Guard's 176th Wing. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Adam.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA. I'd like to thank our producer, Tobin Shelby. And from all of us, all of the hosts here on Outdoor Explorer, I'm Adam Verrier, and I'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.